This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Crime Alert, hourly update, breaking crime news now.
I'm Nicole Parton, the first witness in the sex trafficking trial involving three brothers, two of whom are prominent real estate brokers, recounted her harrowing experience on Tuesday. The excitement of attending a party at actor Zac Efron's apartment swiftly turned into a nightmare when hours later, one of the brothers assaulted her in their residence, taunting her throughout the ordeal. The woman, who spoke under a fictitious name, is among several alleged victims slated to testify against Tal, Oren, and Alon Alexander, who face accusations of drugging and raping women and girls over several years. Defense attorneys for the brothers assert that the encounters were consensual. Prosecutors allege that the Alexander brothers exploited their connections to wealthy and influential people to entice multiple victims. The witness explained that she was just 20 years old and studying anthropology when she met two of the brothers at a party at Efron's New York City apartment. She had accompanied a friend who had recently befriended Tal Alexander, who invited them to watch the final game of the 2012 NBA Finals. She noted that their interaction with Efron was minimal, as he is not implicated in any wrongdoing. After the game, she attended an after party at a Manhattan nightclub where she accepted a drink and lost consciousness. She later woke up in a different apartment, naked, with Alon Alexander standing over her, also unclothed. Despite her attempts to rise, he repeatedly pushed her back down, leading her to declare, "I don't want to have sex with you." She said he laughed and responded, "You already did." She recounted how he then forced himself on her during the assault. Tal Alexander briefly entered the room but did not intervene, leaving her feeling that he was, quote, super nonchalant about the whole thing. Assistant U.S. Attorney Madison Smyers, in her opening remarks to the jury, described the Alexander brothers as perpetrators masquerading as party boys. She stated that they employed various tactics, including luxury accommodations, flights, drugs, alcohol, and sometimes physical force to manipulate women into compromising situations. Defense attorney Tini Garagos, representing Oren Alexander, urged the jury to dismiss the prosecution's monstrous story. Garagos portrayed the brothers, who graduated from college in 2008, as ambitious and occasionally arrogant young men navigating the nightlife scene in search of romantic encounters, arguing that while their behavior may seem immoral, it is not criminal. She suggested that some accusers were pursuing lawsuits for financial gain and only labeled themselves as victims after regretting their choices, such as using illegal drugs or engaging in sexual activities outside their current relationships. Attorney Deanna Paul, representing Tal Alexander, cautioned the jury that the trial's subject matter could be distressing, likened it to an R-rated movie, and emphasizing the prosecution's portrayal of the brothers as, quote, monsters. In a courtroom sketch, the three brothers, Alon, Oren, and Tal Alexander, were seen in Manhattan federal court on the opening day of trial, January 27. Tal and Oren Alexander specialized in high-end real estate in cities like Miami, New York, and L.A., while their brother Alon earned a law degree and managed the family's private security business. Tal is 39. The twins, Alon and Oren, are 38. The indictment claims the men conspired to lure women to vacation spots like the Hamptons by offering flights and luxurious accommodations. Since their arrest in Miami in December of 2024, the brothers have been held without bail. During her testimony on Tuesday, the first witness described how she escaped the room where Alon Alexander had attacked her after he fell asleep. Despite the emotional weight of her testimony, she maintained her composure for the most part, though she became visibly upset at times, particularly when she reflected on reaching out to a friend years later after the incident to remind herself that she was still loved. A judge in Georgia has once again denied bond for a 17-year-old girl accused of murdering her mother and stepfather. During a recent hearing, Carroll County Superior Court Judge Dustin Hightower expressed that there had been no significant changes in the circumstances that would justify freeing Sarah Grace Patrick from her solitary confinement since her arrest in August 25. The judge highlighted ongoing concerns regarding her potential to flee, the risk of witness intimidation, and the safety of the community. Patrick faces two counts of murder and two counts of aggravated assault related to the deaths of James and Christine Brock. She surrendered to authorities in July 25 and has remained in custody without bond since her indictment in August. Her trial is set to take place in August 2026. During the hearing, Patrick's defense attorney argued that she has no criminal prior record, lacks a driver's license or passport, and poses no means to escape. The defense also pointed out that Patrick voluntarily turned herself in and has significant support within the community, as evidenced by 21 character letters submitted to the court and the courtroom filled with supporters. Patrick's maternal grandfather, Dennis Nolan Sr., testified that she poses no danger to him or anyone else, affirming her lack of prior arrest and promising to ensure that she would appear in court if released. Her grandmother, Luann Bruce, who has guardianship of Patrick's younger sister, shared her daily communication with Patrick and expressed confidence that she would not run away. However, during cross-examination, prosecutors revealed that both grandparents, along with Patrick's biological father, DJ, had signed contracts with a media company worth $100,000 for content related to the trial. They clarified that none of the funds would directly go to Patrick or her sister, but the state argued that these media deals heightened concerns about Patrick's potential flight risk. Judge Hightower acknowledged this new information about the media contracts in his decision, expressing that he must consider the possibility that the grandparents could gain financially from increased media attention if Patrick was released.
If I weigh these witnesses' testimonies and I weigh what I hear today, I believe those closest, and I say closest, in family relationship expressed that they had vast concerns that she would have the ability to flee, that she would be a danger to the community, that she would be a danger to them, and that she would be pose a significant risk of intimidating, or actually I think the state steered away from intimidating, or influencing or manipulating witnesses. By finding that, I find the state has met their burden today by preponderance of the evidence. And Miss Patrick, because of that, I'm bound by the law, and I do not believe that you would be a proper candidate for bond at this time.
The defense proposed several strict conditions for her potential release, including house arrest, electronic monitoring, and restrictions on communication with witnesses and victims' families. They suggested that Patrick could reside with a friend just outside Alabama, but prosecutors objected, stating that this would take her outside Georgia's jurisdiction. They also shared a statement from Kim Bowling, James Brock's sister, who voiced fears for her safety and concerns about possible witness intimidation. The defense maintained that the opinions of Bruce and Nolan and the direct deceased family should hold significant weight in the matter. They also emphasized Patrick's age and the detrimental impact of solitary confinement on young individuals, arguing that the delay in her trial to August 26, an additional 8 months, should be taken into account. Judge Hightower addressed Patrick directly, explaining the necessity of the continuance to ensure fairness to both parties, and reiterated that a year and a half from indictment to trial is relatively quick for a murder case. He indicated plans for monthly conference calls to keep the case on track for its scheduled trial date and expressed a desire to avoid any further delays. Sarah Grace Patrick remains in custody at the Carroll County Jail.
A Missouri house of horrors has been exposed after a so-called hardworking mother allegedly traded her children for a cell phone plan, but only after years of locking them in a chicken coop and forcing them into a sick adult-sanctioned fight club. Chantel Hayford, 38, and her boyfriend, Jerry Manise, are rotting in the Washington County Jail after confessing to a stomach-churning catalog of abuse that sounds more like a depraved survival movie than a home in Potosi, Missouri. Authorities from the Washington County Sheriff's Office described the allegations as so disturbing that Sheriff Zach Jacobson initially questioned their credibility. He spoke to the media.
I don't know that I've even heard of a case like this. Locking them in a chicken coop and shooting at them with a BB gun, making them eat bugs, and it's just bizarre.
The real-life nightmare, which spanned from 2023 to late 2025, involved Hayford's 13 and 14-year-old children being treated like livestock. The couple allegedly refused to house the teens indoors, instead padlocking them in an outdoor chicken pen where they were used as human target practice for BB rifles. When they weren't being shot at or pelted with rocks, the malnourished siblings were allegedly forced to consume methamphetamine and non-edible substances like industrial caulking. Even more bizarre, the couple reportedly organized fight nights, even during children's birthday parties, where the teens were compelled to physically beat each other while adults watched. The depravity only ended when the skeletal children escaped to a guardian's home begging for food. In a final act of betrayal, Hayford reportedly signed over custody of the victims in exchange for a cell phone and a service plan. Despite the years of systematic torture, local law enforcement remained completely in the dark, receiving zero reports or hotline tips regarding all the atrocities. In the meantime, both Hayford and Moniz are facing 12 felony counts each, including kidnapping, sexual abuse, and armed criminal action. The pair is being held on $500,000 bonds each, while the children, who cannot read or write after being kept out of school for years, begin a long road to recovery in protective care. The investigation continues.
A Texas man is executed for the 1998 killings of his ex-girlfriend and her new boyfriend, bringing closure to a case that stretched nearly three decades. Charles Victor Thompson was put to death by lethal injection Wednesday night at the Huntsville unit. He was 55. Family members of the victims watched from inside the prison. They emerged just before 7 p.m. after waiting nearly 28 hours. Harris County District Attorney Sean Tears spoke afterward.
This is an incredibly solemn moment when the state takes a life. But the relief that this is over for them was palpable.
The murders happened April 30th, 1998. Thompson went to his ex-girlfriend's Houston home. He confronted her new boyfriend, 31-year-old Darren Keith Kane. Police were called and made Thompson leave. He returned about 3 hours later with the gun. Thompson shot and killed Kane inside the apartment. He then shot Glenda Denise Hayslip in the face. She was 39. She survived the initial shooting but died days later in the hospital. Thompson's case drew national attention years later after his escape from the Harris County Jail. He slipped out of handcuffs during a meeting with his attorney. He changed out of his jail clothes into civilian clothing. He used a fake identification badge and walked right past deputies. Thompson then jumped onto a freight train and traveled to Louisiana. He was arrested 3 days later outside a liquor store in Shreveport while using a payphone. As the lethal injection began, witnesses reported Thompson gasped loudly. He then took about a dozen breaths. Then his breath slowed and turned to snoring. All movement stopped. He was pronounced dead 22 minutes later at 6:50 p.m. Central Time.
He said he was sorry for what happened. He said he was sorry for his actions. He apologized to his children, and he asked his children to find Jesus.
From his final statement, quote, "There are no winners in this situation. It creates more victims and traumatizes more people 28 years later. D.A. Tears says Thompson never fully accepted responsibility for the killings. More crime and justice news after this.
This is an iHeart podcast.
Guaranteed human.